A number of years ago, there was a book that was published. It was a small book geared toward pastors and ministers. It was called The Penguin Principles, and it was an attempt to speak to naive or new pastors to guide them in their relationships with the people in their congregations. Some of it was tongue-in-cheek, meant with a little bit of humor, but as we all know, there's often a lot of truth within that humor. So the first principle of church life that was described in this book was this: despite the pious things that we say at any given time, less than 5% of any group in the church is operating with purely Christian motivation. The other 95% is asking, what's in it for me? Do you think that's true? Pastor William Carter read the book, and he wrote later about this, and he said, when I first read those words, I thought, oh no, that's not true. Church people are inherently generous and gracious, and they are always eager to help, remaining free from selfish motives. Why are you laughing? because Liz has been involved in churches before. But then he said that I then tried to gather a group of teenagers together to form a youth group, and each one of them said, well, what's in it for me? And then I tried to gather a group of adults who would help me as an advisor for the youth group, and one after another, they said, well, what will I get out of it? So it's not easy learning to serve others. A woman accompanied her husband to the doctor's office, and after the examination, the doctor asked to speak to her privately. So her husband left the room, went back to the waiting room, and the doctor said, your husband is suffering from a very severe disease combined with incredible stress in his life. And if you don't do the following, your husband will surely die. So every morning, fix him a healthy breakfast and be very pleasant so that he can start his day as stress-free as possible. And make sure that you make him a very nutritious lunch that he can take along to his work. And then for dinner, prepare an especially nice meal for him. Now, don't burden him with chores, because that will add to his stress. And most importantly, don't discuss your problems with him, because we don't want to add more stress to him. And then, this is the most important thing, make sure that you make love with him 2 to 3 times a week and satisfy his every whim. If you are able to do these things for the next 10 months to a year, I think that we will be able to save your husband's life. So as she and her husband were walking out to the car, he said to her, what did the doctor say to you? Her reply was, you're going to die. When it comes to learning to be a servant. In our gospel lesson today, what we didn't hear was what had preceded James and John coming to him and asking for special places. He had just told the disciples for the third time that he was going to die. He put it in fairly graphic terms this time. He said, the Son of Man, meaning me, will be delivered over to the chief priests, and they are going to condemn me, they are going to put me to death, they're going to mock and spit on me and flog me before they've killed me. But 3 days later, the Son of Man will rise. So this is the third time that he said this, and it's almost as if he's speaking a foreign language every time he has told the disciples this, because they don't hear it, they don't want to accept it, because right after that, James and John come to him, and they're only after their own selfish interests. They approach him privately. That's a red flag right there, because if they were going to be doing something high and noble, they would have done it in front of the whole group. But instead they come to him in private and they say, we want you to do whatever we ask you. Now, those of you who are parents, if you have a child who comes up to you and says, Mommy, Daddy, I want you to do whatever I ask you, you brace yourself, because you know what's coming next is going to be a doozy. Yeah. So Jesus says, what do you want me to do? We want the best places when you come into your glory. And their glory they're talking about is, even despite the predictions of his death, they still think Jesus is going to become a political ruler. And they want to be the prime ministers. One of the things that you might not be aware of is James and John, the sons of Zebedee and Salome, are possibly the cousins of Jesus, because Salome most likely was the sister of Jesus' mother. So the cousins are coming and saying, you know how family hires family, right? We call that nepotism. They had it even back then. And so they're kind of expecting that this is going to happen. Whatever the case, they wanted to get ahead. They wanted to have a position. They are requesting power. Now, Kevin Carter wrote a book called The Call to Downward Mobility. And he said that everybody wants to be somebody. Since the dawn of history, everybody wants to be somebody. Human beings want to be able to rise in the scale of importance. And then he pointed out that even in the biblical story of Adam and Eve, the serpent, the tempter, says, go ahead and eat that fruit, because if you do, you will become like God. Aha, how much higher on the scale can you get than that? So, the long, painful history of church history is that people were more oriented towards getting power over others and always tempted to choose love, to choose power over love, and to choose control over the cross, and to choose being a leader over being led. So, when I was a new pastor, I found out that one of my classmates, Elizabeth, had just gotten a new call as the assistant to the bishop in the Northeastern Pennsylvania Synod. That was my home synod. I was living in upstate New York at the time, serving my first two congregations. But when I found out that she got this call, I was kind of jealous. Like, wow, what about her? Got her this position working for the bishop when I'm doing this? So everybody wants to be somebody, and I found that in myself as well. I found out later from people who were assistants to the bishop that it's not always such a grand job. So after James and John have come to Jesus with this request, he tries to explain again to the whole group, because all the other disciples are mightily put out at this point with James and John, and he says, if you want to be great in my kingdom, you have to learn to be a servant. To be great is to be a servant. And that's why I came, to serve, not to be served. And I came to give my life in exchange for many. But those many are held hostage by power. And Jesus was trying to say, your power, your real power is in serving. Now, here's a story of one who was held hostage by power. It comes from the late 1700s, the American colonies. It's said that during the American Revolution, a man in civilian clothes was riding his horse past a group of soldiers who were repairing a small defensive barrier, perhaps some kind of a wall. Don't know for sure what it was. And the leader was shouting instructions over and over, but not helping. And the man on horseback asked why. And he said, sir, I am a corporal. So the stranger apologized, "Oh, I'm so sorry that I asked," and he got off his horse and he began to help the soldiers rebuild this barrier. When the job was done, he turned to the corporal, who had never helped, and said, "Corporal, next time you have a job like this and not enough men to do it, go to your commander-in-chief and I will come and help you again." And at that point, George Washington got back on his horse and rode off. I have no doubt that Washington was able to model servanthood because somewhere along the line, somebody had modeled it to him. I like to read about the era of our nation's history around World War II, before and after. And I came to know through reading a biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt about a man named Harry Hopkins. Who's ever heard of Harry Hopkins? We got one over here. Anybody else? Another one? All right. Two people have heard of this gentleman. During World War II, he had great influence over FDR. He never held a cabinet position. He had no official position within the administration. And as a result of that, one of Roosevelt's political foes came to him and said, "Why do you keep Hopkins so close to you? You surely realize that people distrust him and resent his influence over you." Well, Roosevelt took his cigarette holder and the smoke twirled around him when he said to his foe, "Someday you may be sitting here where I am now as President of the United States. And when you are, you'll be looking at that door over there, knowing that almost everybody who walks through it wants something from you. And you will realize how lonely a job this is, and you will discover that you need somebody like Harry Hopkins who asks nothing except to serve you." Winston Churchill rated Hopkins as one of the half dozen most powerful men in the world in the early 1940s. And the sole source of his power was his willingness to serve. But he's not remembered that much in history to people. So being a servant does not mean becoming one of notoriety necessarily. Power in serving is what we are called to do with our time, with how we use our talents and abilities, how we use our money. Richard Foster is an author that I've read in the past. His most popular book was something called Celebration of Discipline, in which he outlines how you can use prayer and other disciplines, such as regular worship, to help you grow in your relationship with God. And in Celebration of Discipline, he tells about receiving a phone call from a friend of his, Ben. Ben had not realized that his wife was going to take their only car out that morning, and he had some errands that absolutely needed to be accomplished that day, that morning, in fact. And he said, "Richard, can you drive me to a few places so that I can get this stuff done?" Well, Richard Foster was a professor at a local university, and he was preparing a lecture. And he had a deadline, and he looked at his watch and thought, okay, you know, but Ben said it won't take long. Well, it did take long. Before they headed out the door, Foster grabbed a book, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Life Together, thinking maybe he'd have some chances to read it. And he did, because traffic held them up, and it seemed every stop that Ben made when he'd go into the store or wherever, it took much longer. Well, one time, Ben got out of the car again, headed into the store, and Foster pulled out that book, opened up it up to the bookmark, and read the following: "The second service that one should perform for another in a Christian community is that of active helpfulness. This means, initially, simple assistance in trifling external matters. There is a multitude of these things wherever people live together. Nobody is too good for the meanest service. One who worries about the loss of time that such petty outward acts of helpfulness entail is usually taking the importance of his own career too solemnly. Now, I'm not sure that the Holy Spirit kicks you in the butt as quickly as the Spirit did Richard Foster that day. Learning to be a servant takes a lifetime to move from what's in it for me to ask instead what's in it for Jesus. Christ is always looking for people whose only desire is to serve him. Can I give him your name? Amen.